The BS Report is presented by Subway. Football season is over. Footlong season is just beginning. For a limited time, get any piled high regular footlong for just $5. Any footlong, just $5. Hurry in, Subway. Eat fresh. Eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, it's podcast week here. We came up with podcast week for two reasons. One, this is our first week with Subway as a sponsor. And two, I have to finish my book. And unfortunately, I cannot write any columns this week. So I'm trying to make it up to you with five podcasts. And as the emails have been coming in saying, actually, that doesn't make up for not getting an All-Star Weekend column. Look, I apologize. I don't know what else to tell you. I have to deliver this book on time or else horrible things are going to happen to me and my family. So just bear with me until I'm done. I'll make it up to you down the road, I promise. Today, we're going to have one of my ESPN.com colleagues, somebody that I've had a fundamental and moral battle with. I've compared it to Locke and Jack from Lost, where if basketball is an island, I believe one thing about the island, and our next guest believes something else. Let's bring him on. One of our lead analysts on ESPN.com, used to work for SI.com, used to have a website called Alleyoop.com. My nemesis, my email buddy, John Hollinger. What's happening?
How you doing?
Our first podcast together. This is going to be interesting.
Yeah, it's new ground. You know, I've listened with jealousy for all this time as you've had Stein and Bucher on, so I feel like it's finally my turn to get the conk here.
I think Stein is bumped because he wouldn't, when we did our three-man podcast, he wouldn't give us a little scoop specifically for the podcast. It was like he was too good for us. So I think he's on a year suspension. I think I'm getting rid of him. Hey, you know, we're on different sides of this statistical thing, but I think we're actually on the same side in a weird way. But before we get to all that, I wanted to ask if you had read Michael Lewis's article on Shane Battier in the New York Times Magazine.
Yes. And in fact, I was at that Laker game that he talked about in the article.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you know he was working on a?
I had heard he was there at the game, but I didn't really know why, and I didn't see him.
So he alluded to, you know, that teams are trying to figure out ways for like player-specific stats, basically. And somebody like Battier doesn't really translate to any of the stats we have now, but yet the Rockets GM, Daryl Morey, kind of alluded to that they're figuring out these little subtle ways to maybe measure Battier's value. Do you believe they're ever going to do that?
I'm certain at some point somebody's going to break the code on that. And the biggest part of it is figuring out defense. I mean, that's where most of Battier's value is, obviously. And that is the part that current basketball statistics really haven't been able to penetrate at all. It was a problem in baseball, too, but in baseball, because so much of the interaction is pitcher-batter and the defense is kind of secondary, it wasn't as important.
Right.
And for basketball, especially for a defensive stopper like Battier, it's really important. So that's the one area where statistical analysis really has a long, long way to go with basketball.
And I'm dubious that they'll ever figure it out, because so much of it depends on how you interact with your other teammates. And the stuff that Battier does, I just don't know if you can measure it unless you're actually watching the game. I mean, eventually, I've always thought that we should come up with a stat called nitty gritties, where, you know, basically, if you get a charge, you get one nitty gritty. If you tip a rebound and a whole crowd to a teammate, that's a nitty gritty. Like, maybe the answer is we just need better stats than what we have. And you know, the more I'm thinking about it, are we happy with the stats we have?
Well, I think, again, you look at the defensive stats we have, and they're really poor. And the way that they're really poor is that so much of what happens on defense isn't tracked to any individual player at all. I mean, the three defensive stats we have for individuals are blocks, steals and personal fouls.
Right.
And together they only account for like one play in five. And so the rest of it is just kind of thrown under the rug. And there's some simple things you can track in terms of like deflections, contested shots. It's pretty easy to look and see who put a hand up on a shot, and give them credit for that if the shot misses. And that's just something that hasn't been done systematically by the league. And there are individual teams are tracking a lot of this stuff, and a lot of them you go in the locker room and you see it on a board even. But there's no systematic effort by the league to track it and see who the leaders are and whatnot. So what's the word I'm looking for? It's invisible to the outer world.
I would even say it's a little negligent. And what's funny is that the NBA has been notoriously negligent with stats. For instance, they didn't start keeping track of steals and blocks until the 1973-74 season. And the only reason that happened was because the year before the ABA had started doing it. So here you have Bill Russell who, you know, but everyone from that era says he's the greatest player ever. He won 11 of 13 titles. His stats offensively and his rebound stats were good. Points not as good. Didn't compare to Wilt Chamberlain statistically. On the other hand, we have no way of measuring him defensively. It's basically you just have to trust these anecdotes from people. And if you think about it, it would be the same thing like if we didn't keep track of points for Wilt. And people were just like, yeah, I went to this game in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and I swear Wilt must have had like 90 points, but nobody had any idea. So, you know, this has always been a problem. And now we've advanced to just this decade. I remember writing a column in 2000 for my old website trying to come up with better stats. And one of the stats was plus minus. We didn't even really have plus minus until 5 years ago.
Yeah, which is the simplest thing. I mean, there's a play-by-play sheet that they spit out from every game, so it's the easiest thing to track. Exactly, just basic stuff. And when you say the league has been negligent with their stats, I'd actually take it a step further and say they've been negligent with their history. When you look at not having like a real Hall of Fame and just footage from anything more than like 15 years ago is just completely impossible to find. I mean,
right.
I think it's something they really haven't taken care of the way that baseball especially has.
Oh, believe me, John Hollinger, I'm taking care of this in my book because it's terrible. I mean, the Hall of Fame we have is terrible. The fact that you can't even figure out, like, you know, we have tape of the entire 1969 finals. They couldn't hire one guy to go back and figure out how many blocks Russell had. 1969
right.
finals, how freaking hard would that be? But then you look at the stats we have now, like, for instance, the assist. Now, the assist has changed so many times over the last 50 years that I can't even you're trying to measure, all right, Oscar Robertson had 10 assists a game in 1962 and Stockton had 14 in 1987. You can't even, what does that mean? Because I read stuff from the 50s and 60s, and you only got an assist if, like, the guy didn't dribble before he shot. And
exactly.
Somehow that changed.
Yeah, and it's pretty easy to prove that because the percentage of baskets that were given an assist has increased heavily since the 60s. And the assist is the most problematic basketball stat, though, because it's an opinion. And the other stuff is pretty factual. Player X missed a shot, player Y got the rebound. But the assist at its root is an opinion. And, there's always going to be a fine line between, okay, did the guy take two dribbles because he was streaking to the basket and got a good pass and had the step, or did he do it all on his own? And you can really see that when you look at the home road difference in assists for certain point guards. I mean, Chris Paul, I think, is a shining example. I know this because I was at so many Hornets games last season covering them. I mean, he got some absolutely ridiculous assists in that arena,
right.
Where guys were taking four and five dribbles and making contested jumpers, and he was getting an assist for it. That doesn't mean he isn't a great player, but you do take his assist total with a little bit of a grain of salt because of that, and that's a hard thing to factor into a statistical analysis like this. Is okay, how many, you know, how do we compare these assists apples to apples? And the other thing, you know, you talk about the mega assist, an assist for a dunk obviously is much more valuable than a kick out for a jump shot, and we don't have good ways of tracking that yet.
That was my next thing I was going to mention is it drives me crazy that they don't differentiate between assists. Because, and not just that, but, man, you watch any of Bird and Magic's games from the 80s, And those guys actually left assists on the table because they'd have 4 or 5 plays a game where, you know, they'd bring somebody else's guy over to them, hit somebody for a layup or dunk, but the guy got fouled. They get no credit for that. You get no credit for 2 free throws that you created for somebody else.
You know who got killed on that? It's Stockton.
Right.
Because of all those passes to Malone, where Malone would just throw himself into a guy and go to the line.
Well, and also Nash and Stoudemire, too. Think all the time Stoudemire got racked on that high screen.
Yeah, or anyone who's played with Shaquille O'Neal, obviously, too.
Yeah.
And, that's an obvious example. If a guy goes to the line for 2, you should completely get an assist, or at least keep a separate category for foul assists. Actually, when I go to games, I track this. I've never seen anybody get more than 1 or 2 in a game of those, but I can imagine that, I was never at a Stockton Malone game, obviously, and I can imagine that they probably were games where they had 5 or 6 of those.
Well, I'm really the only person alive who still religiously watches tapes of the 86 Celtics, but Bird would get 1 a quarter. He would, you know, because just that with that team, the spacing was just perfect, so somebody was always open and somebody always had to get fouled. But you were mentioning about how the Chris Paul thing. This is something that really started, supposedly the first guy it started with was Kevin Porter in the late 70s. You look at Kevin Porter's assists and think of what type of player he was. He had some crazy assist season. And he had like, you know, 29 assists in a game, but it was always at home. And
so
if you read Bird's autobiography, Bird had this theory on the West Coast that they would bump the assists, and maybe that kind of explained how Magic's numbers went up a little in Stockton. And I think it just went from there. By the late 80s, you know, if it kind of sort of looked like an assist, you gave the guy an assist. And now there's no way to figure it out. But
there's too many plays that where nothing was really created and the guy gets an assist. I would completely agree with that.
So you agree that maybe mega assist should be in there. We got to figure out a stat to follow what somebody like Battier does. Cause I thought, you know, I didn't really learn anything from that New York Times magazine because I already knew all that stuff, but I was really happy that the general public got to read something like that because again, you know, there's really no way to measure somebody like Battier's value. And you and I have talked about it by email. You have your PER system, which, you know, has some strengths, has some flaws, but Battier got just killed in PR. He was routinely one of the lowest guys in the league, and, you know, you admitted to me he's just not going to translate in that system.
Yeah, I mean, he and Bruce Bowen would be the other one who has always been at the bottom of the league, and again, it's because most of their value is on defense, and defense statistically is just a black box right now. I almost look at PER kind of the way almost you'd look at OPS, that it's telling you a lot more about one half of the floor than the other. I mean, obviously, there's some defensive aspects to it, too, in terms of rebounding and blocks, and neither Battier nor Bowen gets many rebounds. But in terms of, like, one-on-one position defense, that's the one thing it's not telling you anything about.
So what kind of defensive stats could you foresee developing in the next 10 years? Because the league's already gotten a lot nerdier, and I like it, especially like you look at the stats we have now for, you know, somebody's open field goal percentage, if they're shooting at the top of the key. Like, it's definitely becoming more complex in a good way, and maybe that's where this is going.
Yeah, offensively, certainly, with the things people are doing with shot charts now is taking it to a whole other level. But defensively, I think people are trying a lot of stuff with on-court versus off-court differential right now, and I think they're finding that it's telling them less than they thought it would. And there's a couple reasons for that. I mean, you're measuring 10 variables at once, essentially, and a lot of those variables don't change because players tend to be on the court with the same other players at the same time. Mm-hmm. So the numbers you get are actually a lot less reliable than you'd imagine. So I think somehow it needs to get back to the individual. Now, the hard part with rating individuals on D is that it gets a lot of times to opinions again, like with the assist, and it also depends a little bit on if you're watching a tape of a game and you're trying to say, okay, whose fault was this basket? One of the things you need to know is what the coach wanted them to do, how they were supposed to play against something.
Right.
And you, you can't know that for all 30 teams at once. I mean, you know, people track this for their own teams, but to track it for all 30 teams is impossible, and that's a difficult thing to get around. But I do think it has to start with the league tracking more basic nuts and bolts type stuff, like shots contested, like deflections. They still don't keep a tally of league leaders in drawing offensive fouls. I mean, you can find out in 82 games, but it's not something that the league systematically tracks, which is just ridiculous to me. I mean, that's one of the easiest ones of all.
And another one that they don't do, that it really only applies to a few guys, but for instance, Wes Unseld, who won the MVP 1 year, although he shouldn't have, he was the master of the outlet pass. Now, he didn't get an assist for that, but he would get a rebound, throw it 50 feet down the court to one of the guards, and they'd dribble half the court or they'd pass to somebody else. It would lead to a basket, but he never got credit for this, and historically, there's no way to know that he did that. Whereas in a sport like baseball, offensively, you could measure every kind of impact the guy had on a game, basically. And that's really the difference. I could live on a desert island and get the 2010 baseball prospectus and really kind of figure out what happened for that season. With basketball, if I got the NBA Register, I don't think I could. I could get an idea, you know, but I couldn't totally do it. And that's the big difference. But when you're talking about plus minus, I know that, you know, the teams are really, this seems to be the statistic they're really trying to explore. And even Daryl in the Mike Lewis article, he was a little coy about it. Like, yeah, we think we've kind of figured out. I don't think there's any way to figure it out. Like, you look at the Celtics, Paul Pierce comes out and Tony Allen comes in. Tony Allen stinks. The team's worse every time he's in there. We always lose points in the second quarter or the fourth quarter if they played a good team. So Pierce's plus minus, just by the fact that Tony Allen is his backup, is going to be skewed. So I don't know how you solve that.
Yeah, I call it the bad backup effect. And Kevin Garnett's plus minus when he was in Minnesota was just off the charts because of that.
Right.
Teams are trying to take the next step, and that's why I said they're trying to measure all 10 variables at once by tracking not only who's on the court, but who else is on the court with them, and how that might affect what their plus minus is while they're out there. The problem is it's like this massive calculus problem, and when you start separating out when players aren't on the court with the other guys they usually play with, that ends up driving most of the measurement, and that is an incredibly small sample most of the time. So what most of the guys who research this has found is that you really need a couple of years worth of data, which for most of what you're doing with an NBA team isn't really that helpful, because, you know, you say, okay, well, this guy was great 2 years ago, but, you know, what is he now? And that's the thing the teams really want to know. So there's still a lot of issues with measuring that.
So here's where we get to the lock versus jack part of our debate. So you are convinced, and your PER, you know, it's really gained some steam, and it's probably become the most accepted tool for doing this. You are convinced that you can evaluate players against other players. I am convinced that too much of it depends on who your teammates are and what your situation is, and more importantly, that basketball is the one sport where you can't do that. Because we already have simple statistics to do it, but more importantly, it's a sport where you really have to watch what's happening. You take somebody like Amari Stoudemire, for example, who tragically got voted into the All-Star game this year, even though he grabs two rebounds a quarter and he doesn't switch on high screens and he makes his team, you know, unfathomably worse defensively and doesn't care. But this is somebody that, you know, in a PER type system is going to look really good. How do you reconcile that?
Well, I think you just say what you said. I mean, he puts up offensive numbers. He doesn't play any defense. That's what he is. I mean, at the end of the day, the PER is only as good as what goes into it. And what goes into it right now, because defense is a black box, that we don't have any good real usable data for, is the offensive numbers. And so you just adjust for that, I guess, is how I always do it mentally. Yeah, okay. So I think to myself, okay, what's a horrible defensive player with a PR of 20 worth? And that's kind of how I go about it anyway.
So maybe we should combine. We could come up with the Smolinger rankings, where I'd rate defense and intangibles and whether anybody would want to play with the guy on a scale 1 to 10. You use PR, and then somehow we merge in the middle. That'd be interesting. How did you figure out you're involved in this trade machine? It's you rate every trade or something. How did that? What is the system for that?
It's built off PER, but there's a defensive adjustment in there too. That's subjective, but that I put in so that, for example, it wouldn't say, oh yeah, if you trade Tim Duncan for Al Jefferson, everything will be just the same, you know.
Right.
So there's an adjustment in there for that, and then, but it's based off of PER and what a team's rotation would be before and after the trade.
So you're like a mad scientist just coming up with formulas. Well, explain PER. Can you explain it in two sentences?
Yes. It is a rating of a player's per minute statistical accomplishments.
Okay. Oh, that was one sentence.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I've got it down. I've been asked this on the radio a lot. I mean, I've every time it gets a little shorter.
What is the biggest strength of PER in your opinion?
The ability to do comparisons, not only between players, but between seasons, look at the same player over different seasons and know pretty quickly who's going up or down and how somebody's performance rates to league averages and what other teams are getting from that position. So I think at bottom line, it's the ability to do comparisons. It's so helpful with that.
Biggest weakness?
Defense.
See, I would throw in a second one that's not as big, but I worry about the per minute stat. For instance, like, you know, you wrote recently about Greg Oden that his rebound rate was excellent, which it is. But he's also having a lot of trouble staying on the court because he gets in foul trouble. Mm-hmm. Now, in my opinion, those two things are related. I think it's easier to get a rebound if you're just jumping over guys' backs and you're not worrying about getting into foul trouble. There's a balance that you have to find as a big man. And he hasn't found it yet, which is why he can't stay on the court. So his rebound rate might look good, but it's coming at the expense of his team, which is a bad thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, I mean, you can argue that actually, if you look at rebound rate, almost all the guys with high rebound rates get a ton of over the back calls. I mean, you look at like Reggie Evans, Sam Dallenberg, Chris Billa, Odin's teammate there. I mean,
right.
All those guys are getting lots of over the back calls too.
It's also easier for somebody to play 15 and 20 minutes a game as at the highest possible level of intensity that they have versus somebody who paces themselves over the course of 40 minutes again.
You
don't agree?
No, because I researched it. And players tend, I mean, within reasonable human limits, players tend to play better the longer run they get. Players tend to do better when they start than when they come off the bench. They tend to do better when they play 25 minutes than when they play 15. Obviously, you know, there's limits to this. If you play Eddie Curry all 48 minutes, you're going to see some diminishing returns. But in general, players do better the longer they're out there. And it makes sense. Those first couple minutes, you're cold. And you look at guys, especially when they play small chunks, when they, you know, have games where they play 4 minutes or 8 minutes, usually you don't get much from them.
See, I would agree with that for point guards and shooters, but there's a specific type of player that seems to do a little bit too well for me in your PER, and it's the Maurice Spates type guy. It's the guy who plays 16 to 20 minutes coming off the bench, an energy guy who doesn't take a lot of shots that he's not going to make, who gets rebounds, and, you know, maybe plays his typical box score would be 18 minutes, maybe 10 points, 6 rebounds. He makes 58% of his field goal. And that's a guy, for whatever reason, translates really well to PER, and I'm not sure why.
Well, so I think Spates is going to be a heck of a player. I mean,
well, I agree with you on that. I'm saying irrelevant of that. I'm just saying that type of player, like a Jason Thompson, Maurice Spates type guy.
An energy power. Well, look at Paul Millsap. I mean, he went from backup to starter, and his numbers actually got even better.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I was proud of you that I checked your PR to see how bad Big Baby Davis was when he was, you know, just murdering the Celtics. Now it hasn't been that bad. But he was way down there, and I was like, yes, PR comes through. Measures him and Tony Allen as being the excruciating bench players that they are. All right, so here are your PR for power forwards. So Tim Duncan, 25.38 leads your power forward list. I like that. But Duncan, Boozer, Nowitzki, Bosch, Gasol, Garnett. That's your top six. Mm-hmm. Seems fair. That seems like, you know, that's how I would expect it to look. Coming in seventh, Maurice Spates playing 15.5 minutes a game. Mm-hmm. So you're saying to me that based on the Paul Millsap corollary, I should expect him to put up projected numbers that would be double the numbers that he has now if he played twice as many minutes.
Roughly, I mean, the one thing I'll say for Spates is this. I mean, we're looking at a sample of 600 minutes here. I know in our email I used the example of a guy hitting 400 after 150 at-bats.
Right.
You don't necessarily say he's a 400 hitter. You say, wow, he's been playing really great. I mean, Spates has been playing really great. I don't know that he could play at this level for a full season.
I worry about his motor.
We don't have any history with him. We don't know if this is a season that's completely over his head, or if this is his normal, if this is his normal output.
Now here's your rankings for all positions. LeBron, Chris Paul, Dwayne Wade is the top three. Ironically, that would be my top three. Dwight Howard, Tim Duncan, Kobe. Those are 4, 5, and 6. Now, when I did my trade value column for ESPN, that was the top six. So that's
okay.
Interesting. Carlos Boozer, 7. He's only played 12 games.
Right.
Brandon Roy, Yao Ming, Al Jefferson, the top 10. I like all of that. Manu Ginobili, Dirk Nowitzki, Devin Harris, Chris Bosh, Pau Gasol, 11 through 15. Parker, Shaq, Garnett, Danny Granger, and Maurice Spates fills out the top 20. I gotta say, I'm on board with how that looks. I think the PER did a nice job this year.
Thank you.
So has anybody ever approached 32 like LeBron right now?
Jordan. I mean, LeBron is threatening the highest PER I'd say of all time, but it's actually since the league started tracking turnovers and blocks and steals. So since 74. He is threatening to put up the best one of all time. I think he's probably not going to get there, but it's close.
What was Jordan's highest ever?
Amazingly,
did he hit 33?
It was just over 32, I think. I don't have that in front of me for some reason. I can't remember what it was.
That's
but
all right.
It's LeBron is like right there with him. I think he's probably not going to get there just because in that last week of the season, if their playoff position is assured, I think he might have some like 20-minute games where he takes 4 shots, and that'll probably take him down a little bit. I mean, Jordan had those too, obviously. But
I'm gonna say that it goes the other way because they're basically gonna be battling the Celtics for that number one seed. I could see both of those teams playing hard the whole time. You know?
Yeah, you're right. It all depends on how close they are.
Yeah.
That final week and if those last two games end up mattering or not. Because sometimes, too, like, even though a team will be one game back, they'll see Boston is playing, like, home against Memphis, and so they won't even bother.
So Chris Paul is at the highest point guard PER you've ever measured? He's almost at 30.
That would be the best.
So eventually, now let's say stats get more complex and they start taking care of some of the stats we mentioned, like the Shane Battier type stats, like what were we saying? Like ricochets, picking up loose balls, and you know,
contesting shots,
and tipping a rebound at teammates, all those taking a charge. So if we eventually have those stats, you can incorporate that in a PER, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Because you already have blocks and steals in there.
I have blocks, steals, and personal fouls.
Yeah, God, I can't believe how bad the defensive stats are. Or that nobody cares. It's unbelievable to me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like in 1974, they were like, yeah, we gave you guys blocks and steals. We're going to be good for the next 35 years. Good luck with that. Meanwhile, we have no way of measuring Bill Russell, the greatest player ever. There's literally no way except for rebounds. All right, so let's talk about the Michael Lewis thing and the impact it had on the basketball stats community, of which you are a big part of, because obviously that was the biggest mainstream basketball stats piece ever.
Right. I think it was kind of stuff we all knew. I don't think it changed anything for any of us.
But it changed the basketball community a little bit. You must have gotten a ton of emails about it.
I would hope a wider audience read this and is asking more questions about it now. But honestly, I mean, the thing that really changed everything for folks on the basketball side was Moneyball, even though it wasn't about basketball, because all these front office people and owners read it and started asking questions about how they could do it with basketball.
Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, I mean, Daryl Morey obviously is doing it right now, and other teams are trying to some extent, a lot of them.
But Daryl's the only one that's done it. He's the only stat-oriented GM that's been hired so far.
Yeah, I would say that. Although, I mean, there's definitely other GMs who maybe their stat guy resume wasn't as deep as Daryl's, but there are definitely other guys who are interested in this stuff and using it. We'll see. I mean, if there's more Daryls now. I mean, even in baseball, there's only a couple still.
And now in baseball, it seems like because everybody is kind of operating from the same playbook now, which is amazing. It didn't happen sooner. Like that, people didn't realize, hey, whip and OPS. It's probably good if the guy has a good whip and OPS. But now it's gravitating toward defensive stats, which is also really interesting because that's a little bit harder to measure. But it seems like they have come up with at least a few effective ways of doing it. I'm not totally sold. It seems like they're about 75%
there. Even in baseball, it took them a long time because in the 80s they were doing stuff like range factor, which was it was all over the map. We tell you, like, Roy Smalley was the best shortstop in the American League and stuff. So it's really only these last few years that I think they've really gotten a handle on it.
When did you fall into the whole stat thing? Was it something you were into as a kid, or was it as an adult? When did it really catch on?
As a kid, I mean, I was keeping stats and stuff on baseball and football and basketball too. I mean, when I was like 5 and 6 years old and stuff, I mean, it's just ingrained in that part of my brain. And then when I first read the baseball abstract books, that really took it to another level for me and showed me how much potential there was with this type of thing.
Were you playing Stratomatic and what if and not?
Oh, did I play Strato? Oh my goodness, yeah. I played all the big four in Strato. Basketball was the worst game, unfortunately.
Yeah.
They never really got that one figured out. But the baseball game was gold, obviously. The hockey game was really good. I played a ton of Strato hockey.
What about Micro League?
Never played it.
Really? Never played Micro League? Yeah, so I think me and my buddy Gus were the only two who played it. We played entire seasons and kept stats. That's how far we went. It was like with the first computer baseball game, basically. So were you in, were you in on fantasy early?
No, I wasn't, oddly enough. I was kind of late to fantasy.
Huh. So when did you decide you could do this for a career? Was that after college, during college?
I actually fell into it kind of by accident. I set up a, let's see, this was like 96. So I was like a couple years out of college and just set up, when the internet first came around, I decided to make a website and I would just like put my ramblings around sports, about sports there. And, that just kind of steamrolled from there.
So when did SI.com hire you?
That was in 2002, I think.
And when did you create PER?
That was when I was still doing my website. That was like 98, I think.
Really?
And Yeah. And I just had it, on my website. It was called alleyoop.com. I had it on there for a couple of years, and then eventually I wrote the first of the books, the basketball prospectus or basketball forecast. It changed its name halfway through the run. The web thing was kind of what led to that book, and then the book is what led to the other stuff.
I got to say, alleyoop.com is a very strong URL.
Thank you.
That's really one of the best ones.
That's the advantage of getting a URL in 1996. There were still like names like that available.
Oh, my God. You know, I started on AOL in 97, and my column, it was called Boston Sports Guy, and the only reason it was called that was because they had a guy called Boston's Movie Guy. So when they gave me a column, they said, they were like, what do you want to call it? And I was like, I like that movie guy's name. We'll call it Boston Sports Guy. So it was only available on AOL. And for like 6 months, I was fighting to get a keyword, an AOL keyword. So finally I got like Sports Guy as a keyword and Bill Simmons as a keyword. And I was, oh yeah, now I made it. I got a keyword. Meanwhile, it never occurs to me to buy a URL. So when they finally went on the internet, you know, finally it became like not just AOL users, anybody could do it. And this was like, you know, fall 98. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I'll buy the URLs. And the Sports Guy one was gone, but I got bostonsportsguy.com. But I don't know what the hell I was thinking. It haunts me. Not just sportsguy.com, but I would have bought a bunch of them because I kind of, you know, my whole career was basically betting on the internet at that point.
Right.
Never occurred to me to get the URL. So what is Alleyoop the only one you owned?
It is the only one I own. And in retrospect, I should have bought a bunch of others too. There are some juicy ones out there. I remember looking one night and there were like some good ones, like, you know, some there were like some major cities that hadn't got their own URL yet and things like that. So it could have turned very profitable for me. I just wasn't forward thinking enough, I guess.
Well, how expensive was it? I can't even remember. Wasn't it kind of expensive?
$40.
Yeah, it was expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially for broke internet
writers.
I guess
when you're 24, it's like, oh, $40, you know. But
yeah. Yeah, because you could have owned basketballstats.com. You probably could have had all the relevant stat ones. So, do you have other friends in the statistical community that you bounce stuff off of, or is it like everybody's in competition with one another?
You know what's weird is that almost everyone else is working for teams now.
Really?
So,
like secretly?
Some secretly, some openly.
Hmm.
And so because of that, there's a lot less discussion than there used to be. We still bounce things off each other sometimes. I mean, there's a bulletin board that we're all on, and there is a lot of discussion there, but.
Is it a bulletin board that I could go to?
Yeah. Association of Pro Basketball Research.
Interesting. So
Kevin Pelton runs the bulletin board, actually.
I just, you know, he's kind of grown on me. I'm still not totally sold on this whole stat thing. But I end up gleaming things from pieces. It really comes down to who's writing it, to be honest, because there's some real idiots out there, and I won't say who they are, but there's just some people that are just dopes that are, you know, that they're so trapped in their stats that they're not actually looking for any sort of context. Pelton, I think, has a nice balance. He had a really good column about the Suns this week that was something about, you know, that Barbosa, that the common theme is that his stats have gone down because of D'Antoni, and actually they're just the same. It was actually interesting. I learned from it. So I think that's kind of where we're going. I think it's going to be a blend of here are the numbers that back up what I'm saying, but also I'm actually watching the games too. Like maybe that's our manifest destiny here.
Yeah, and that's you have to watch what's going on and see those things and you have to know what people are talking about too in terms of one of the real ways that the staff can be useful is by pointing out where the conventional wisdom is wrong and why it is wrong.
Right.
And that requires paying attention to what the conventional wisdom is, obviously, and what's going on in the games, and seeing the whole picture.
Here's my big issue with StatGuys. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
I I understand that it's fun for them to take whatever mainstream opinion is out there and then try to prove that person wrong with stats. And that's become an accepted baseball thing that has really, in my opinion, kind of nerded down baseball writing to some degree. I think people are so trapped now in the stats that you're not allowed to have an opinion on anything in baseball anymore unless you back it up with 50,000 stats. I mean, you're really not. So it's almost not fun to follow baseball anymore other than just being a casual fan, because I don't have time to learn what everybody's VORP is, you know, and all these crazy stats that people have. I'm not against people spending the time on doing it, but, you know, at some point, it's kind of fun to watch a game and be like, man, I wish Manny Ramirez was up right now instead of Jason Bay in the seventh inning here, because I feel like Manny would have a better chance of getting a hit. I can't back that up with stats, and maybe Jason Bay's OPS has been just as good for the last 3 weeks, whatever. It's just kind of a feeling you get, and that's part of what following sports is. And I think on the baseball side, they've become a little arrogant with, oh, you're such an idiot. I mean, here's the blah, blah, blah. And I don't want to see that happen in basketball. And, you know, I think we've shaded into that a little bit. You're very good at not doing it. I think other guys are not as confident at not doing it. But, you know, my whole thing is that it's a discussion. We're all throwing out opinions. Some of them are based on what we're watching. Some of them are based on stats that we've come up with. But I don't know if anybody could just say I'm right. At least you have to respect what the other opinions are, you know what I mean? And that's where I worry about with this baseball, with basketball stats. And if they become too complex, it's going to become like baseball. And
yeah, I think there's less chance of that happening in basketball just because there's so much interaction and a lot of what goes on kind of depends on those interactions between the five players, which is something that never really comes up in baseball. You know, maybe a guy takes a couple pitches to let a guy steal, but otherwise, it's pretty much straight one-on-one battles, and it just isn't like that in basketball. And so I think because of that, there's always going to be a lot more wiggle room in the arguments and a lot more nuance to everything we're talking about. So I guess I worry about that less with basketball. I mean, there's always going to be people, I mean, whether they're working with numbers or whether they're scouts or whatever, who, you know, who act like they're Moses coming down from the mountain with the tablets and this is how it is. Mm. But I don't think that's going to take over the discussion in basketball to nearly the same extent.
I hope not. You've only made me mad once in the piece. It was your 50 greatest final performance.
About the Celtics.
No, it wasn't about the Celtics. It was your 50 greatest final performances ever by PR.
Uh-huh.
Dwayne Wade was number one for the 2000.
You wanted Dwayne Wade and Bennett Salvatore to be co-number ones?
Well, I thought Bennett Salvatore actually would have been a better choice for number one. But I just don't, you know, if whatever system you're using comes up with Dwayne Wade being number one in a series that the officiating really damaged basketball and – you know, the way things were officiated had such a dramatic impact on what the stats were for those games and how it was played. I think that has to be acknowledged. And on the flip side, we've never seen anybody do what Jordan did in 91, 92, and 93. And then to, you know, not as quite with the same statistical impact, but in 96, 97, 98, the way he carried those Bulls teams that really, especially that 98 Bulls team just sucked. I mean, that's probably the worst 2-12 squad that's ever won a title. It's just hard for me to believe he couldn't have been higher than 8 with whatever engine you're using. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. There were in every individual finals with Jordan, there was like a but. There was like there was always a game in there where he didn't play that well or you know, when you're talking about all-time performances obviously. So there are always little things pulling him down in each individual series. I mean, obviously we remember the incredible performances. I mean, that sick game against Utah was one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. But when you look at the whole six games, I mean, Wade was superb every single game. And then in a couple of the games, he was just ridiculous. Now you know, you can argue how big an impact the officials had on that. That's what made him number one, is that it was the body of work, the whole six games.
Right.
He was just superb.
See, I would have said the 93 finals with Jordan against Phoenix was more impressive because, and his whole playoffs in general, because of the pounding that he had taken that whole postseason, the way that the game was officiated back then, where you really could
right.
knock guys down and stuff. By the
yeah,
time,
and that's the one thing that I think that even now, you know, you have LeBron coming here and you know, who might break the PER record, and if he doesn't do it this year, he might in coming years. And when you look at Wade in the finals, it is much easier for a guard to dominate the game now.
Right.
I don't think there's any question about that. And
yeah.
That's, you know, and that gets back to, I mean, this, the numbers at the heart of it are more information. And then you still have the information outside of that you add to the recipe to come up with the whole mixture.
One last question about this whole stat thing. You and I disagree on the value of less possessions versus more possessions. For instance, you know, you look at the Malone Stockton numbers from the mid-90s when the game had really slowed down to a point that it was damaging from a fan interest. And there were less possessions, but Malone was putting up kind of similar numbers to what he had been putting up when there was a faster pace. Now, you say that he should be rewarded historically for that. And in my opinion, I actually think it's easier to play a game in less possessions because you're not flying up and down the court. You have control over every play. And for a team like that, where they're just running the high screen over and over again, actually it benefited them. So how do you reconcile the whole possessions thing just in general?
Well, I think I try to see everything on a per possession basis as much as I can. So if a guy's doing more in the same number of possessions, I'm always going to treat that as being better. The argument I think you're trying to make for Malone is that for him, it was easier if there was a controlled game because they could run every play for him then. Whereas
right.
if they're just flying up and down the floor, it's kind of whoever's open on the wing is getting the ball to come in and finish. And so it was, I think you can make that argument that it was easier for Malone to put up numbers in a slower pace.
And Stockton, too, I think, because both those guys were older. They didn't, you know, I don't know if they could have played at that 88 to 93 pace at
yeah,
that point
Stockton,
in their careers like they did.
Stockton was putting up crazy assist numbers, though, when they were running. So I don't know if it impacted him as much. I mean, the thing with Stockton, there was a guy who limiting his minutes, I think, really helped him late in
right.
his career.
And I think that's something that has hurt Steve Nash. Because he is still playing 36, 38, 40 minutes a game, and I think if he was on the Jerry Sloan plan, he'd probably be more productive.
You yeah, I mean? It's funny because we were talking about this with him yesterday at practice because he said his average minutes isn't that high this year because he's left a couple games early and there's been a few blowouts where he didn't play in the second half. But he said, you know, when we have a close game, I'm playing 40 minutes, and it's really kind of wearing me down.
Right, and that's bad for him. He mentioned
yeah.
that to me when I was talking All-Star Weekend. Well, we were talking about really for the last 8-9 years of John Stockton's career, they had that thing where he came out at the 6-minute mark of the second or the 6-minute mark.
First quarter, yeah.
First quarter,
yeah.
And then the 6-minute mark of the third quarter. And that's just what they did. They didn't care who their backup point guard was. This is just what they were going to do. And I really think that was part of what made him play for so long, that they took care of him so carefully over that last 10 years. And you know, if you're looking at Nash from a historical standpoint, I worry about how long he's going to last lugging these minutes with a bad back. I could just see him flaming out pretty quickly if they don't take care of that.
Yeah, and his it's not just the back. You know, I mean, he's got his shoulders really bothering him too. So
yeah.
it's getting to be a number of ailments with him. Yeah, I agree. I mean, Steve, there's a guy who, if you can manage him like they managed Stockton, or like the Spurs managed Ginobili, I think you probably can get a lot more out of him. But I don't know if the Suns care at this point. I mean, they only have 1 year left with him.
Yeah, well, what, do they have an option for this summer? They
it's,
did.
He's a 2010 free agent, I thought.
Yeah. Well, no, I think they have a team option this year that they're obviously going to exercise because
oh, yeah.
it's only for $12 million. Although
yeah.
with Sarver, you never know. He might just say, hey, we saved $12 million.
That's great.
That's true. That's the wild card in this whole Amari trade thing, I guess, is they could not pick that up and get under the tax that way. Their fan base might set the arena on fire. But
I was going to say that that's the only way they could really antagonize their fans anymore, other than actually killing Steve Nash during a game, having him executed. But anyway, so you're going tonight to Suns and who?
Clippers.
Oh, the Clips.
Yeah, they have a home and home with the Clips, actually. They're going to be in L.A. tomorrow.
Oh, believe me, I'm going to be there. I'm excited to have the run-and-gun Suns back, although I'm not sure how this is going to work with Shaq. But it will
be very, I think everyone's a little curious. And we were talking about this yesterday at practice. There's only a few guys that are there that played more than a year under D'Antoni.
Right.
I mean, it's really just Nash, Stoudemire, and Barbosa. I mean, Hill was there 1 year. Shaq was there like 2 months.
Yeah.
And so it's new to a lot of these guys. So it's going to be interesting to see, especially these first couple weeks under Gentry, how it goes.
I am intrigued as well. I'm also intrigued to see if he does some things that Terry Porter was not doing. Terry Porter was just, it wasn't even just the fact that he was so stubborn about making them play a certain way, but he just wasn't even trying player combinations. Kevin Pelton did a good job of that in his piece, like saying Barbosa, Richardson, and Nash had only played together for like 67 minutes total. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, you go small ball with those guys, and that's like a tough lineup to match against. I would have thought.
You have 340% 3-point shooters on the outside around Shaq and Amari. That, I mean.
Yeah. I mean, they could have.
Why would you want to do that, right?
When they made that trade, I thought that one of the lineups they would have would basically replicate what the 2007 Warriors did, because you would have Nash in the Nash in the Baron Davis role, Barbosa in the Monte Ellis role, Richardson as Richardson, Barnes as Matt Barnes, and then Amari as the one big man.
Yeah.
And they just run with those guys. They just seemed like a natural to me, and they never did it. So now I'm wondering if they break out that lineup, assuming Richardson doesn't get imprisoned for whatever his next offense is going to be. I think that's a tough lineup. I wouldn't want to play that lineup. Just run and gun with those guys?
I completely agree. I thought they were going to do that after the Charlotte trade too. I thought Richardson was going to play a lot of three with the Nash Barbosa backcourt, and then they could do whatever, and then they could play Barnes Stoudemire. They could play Stoudemire Shaq too. I mean, if you double Shaq and have all those shooters around him,
right?
That's pretty tough too. And so,
I'm intrigued by them. We'll see tonight. We'll see. We'll know more in this home and home. Make sure you throw a hot dog at Mike Dunleavy for me. Or a piece of popcorn or something, just for me, because I can't be there. John Hollinger, thanks for coming on, and we'll have you again on soon.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
All right, take care. All right, I want to hit a couple emails before we go for the day. One of them is about the podcast I did with Joe House yesterday about my unsavory experience at Casino Arizona. Will from San Diego writes, I found myself at this casino one night about 2 years ago. I had the exact same impressions as you. The cigarette smoke is oppressive. The dealers are icy. And the drink prices and the fact that prices even exist are ridiculous. I'm willing to bet you've received many more emails complaining about this place. So I say you read them aloud during the next podcast when we bring this place to the ground. Will, unfortunately, that was the only one I got. Although I did not check through all the emails, but that was the only one I saw. So anyway, if you have bad Casino Arizona experiences, please send them along, because I decided that maybe I will bring that place to the ground. Daniel from Columbia just writes, Joe Mead is going to kill you. Sorry. Joe, you're not going to kill me, are you?
I don't think so, Bill. What makes him think that?
People seem to think you don't like me, and you're going to quit during a podcast or something.
That's ridiculous, Bill.
I say you're just playing it low-key. You're like doing the Pat Summerall.
Very low-key. Actually, want to share something with the world.
Yeah.
The only job I really applied for as a senior in college.
Yeah.
That I actually like took time, thought about, was applying to be your intern.
Oh, I'm going to applaud that one, Joe Mead. See, you care. I knew you cared. I knew it was lurking in there somewhere. Once again, we've kept our streak alive. Every week we've found out something about Joe Mead. I'm surprised I didn't hire you, or at least put you in the running since you went to Notre Dame.
You know, I think when I emailed in, it said, you know, mailbox is full. Tried sending it a few more times. Oh, well.
Ed from Raleigh, North Carolina says that Kaka who we covered yesterday. He plays for AC Milan, consistently one of the best Italian teams. Player of the World a couple years ago. Manchester City recently offered £100 million for him, which would have made him the most expensive player ever. And it didn't happen. So, I mean, really, the fact that I didn't know anything about Kaká, much less how his name was pronounced, exposed me as a sports fan, Kaká. Corey in St. Louis says, you and House were talking on your podcast about possible NBA cities, New Orleans, New Jersey, when New Orleans, New Jersey, Memphis moved their teams. You didn't mention St. Louis as an option. Is there another city other than Seattle that makes more sense? Actually, there is. A bunch of fans from Kansas City wrote and said, hey, we have the brand new Sprint Center. We're ready for a team. I got so many emails that from Kansas City fans who are just waiting for one of these teams to fall in their laps. So I apologize for not including Kansas City in the mix. So actually, we got another email. Suitable NHL arenas without an NBA tenant. So you got Anaheim in 1993, Buffalo in 1996, Columbus, Ohio in 2000, Montreal 96, Nashville 96, Ottawa 96, Pittsburgh, this is another one which I didn't realize, they're building that new arena for hockey that's going to be done in 2010, so maybe they become a player. Raleigh, North Carolina 1999, St. Louis 1994, San Jose 1993, Tampa 96, and Vancouver, ironically, 1995. So yeah, maybe Kansas City. You know what's really interesting? Another guy emailed me, what if the Sacramento Kings move back to Kansas City? Joe Mead.
Yeah.
How about that? That would be like when Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor got remarried. I couldn't come up with a more modern pop culture analogy. Don Johnson, Melanie Griffith. Imagine that. Kings leave, then come back to Kansas City.
It's been a long time.
See, I'm on board with that. I'm on board with I don't like when franchises lose their teams. Like, I hated the Sonics thing. And by the way, I'd like to apologize for accidentally mentioning the city that cannot be named in yesterday's podcast. And Joe Mead would also like to apologize for not bleeping it. I'm okay with the Kings moving back to Kansas City. I know it would hurt the Sacramento fans. I know they have good crowds. But really, you took the team from Kansas City. So it's almost like trying to think of an analogy. Demi Moore leaving Bruce Willis for Ashton Kutcher, spending 10 years with him, and then going back to Bruce Willis. So I'm okay with the Kansas City Kings. And in fact, I'm kind of secretly rooting for it. And I'd also like to see Anaheim get a team, just because I need to feel better about Anaheim. Currently, it's probably my least favorite city. John in Palm Harbor, Florida, writes, he understood why I got Ronaldo and Ronaldinho mixed up. Brazilian Ronaldo, he's a three-time World Player of the Year who was caught with transsexual hookers while rehabbing his knee in Brazil last year. That's true. I looked it up. Portuguese Ronaldo is the current World Player of the Year and was involved in a hooker orgy with two of his teammates a couple of years ago. That's also true. I looked it up. So his point was that it gets very confusing. So actually, there's transsexual Ronaldo and then Portuguese hooker orgy Ronaldo. And that's how I will now keep track of those. Ty in Atlanta said that based on your All-Star Game podcast, apparently Joe House eats a foot-long sub with double meat and two bags of chips for a meal. How long until the Yankees give him $160 million? That's excellent. That's the email of the week. So that's it for a couple of emails related to this week. Tomorrow we have an old friend of ours, one of my favorite podcast guests, probably on my Mount Rushmore of podcast guests, Mr. Chris Connolly. He's going to come on and talk about Oscars and a whole bunch of other dumb stuff. Until then, we'll see you on the Bills Room.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.